Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, it's Hamish from the Young Investors Podcast. Myself and Brandon are excited to bring you your weekly rundown of the latest business and investing news from around the world. A quick reminder before we get started, any advice provided by Brandon is general and does not consider your financial situation, needs, or objectives, so consider whether it's appropriate for you. Brandon van der Kolk is authorized to provide general financial product advice in Australia and is authorized representative number 1305795 of Guideway Financial Services Proprietary Limited, AFSL number 420367. Please see the description box for Brandon's financial services guide. Past performance is not a reliable indication of future investment returns. But with that said, let's get into another episode of the Young Investors Podcast.
All right, guys, welcome back.
Hamish Hodder,
how are you going, mate?
I'm doing well. Cracking? How are you?
What's cracking?
Yeah, I'm good, mate.
Not much. Another day in Melbourne.
Yeah. Yep.
That's pretty much it.
Weather's warming up.
Some days. I mean, it's still very up and down, which is very annoying, but it's been good. It's been going well. Mm. Yeah. You? What's new?
I've actually been sick the last couple of days. You were sick twice in a row and then
now
it's my turn. So there you go. You've transmitted it over the airwaves. Yeah. We actually got a comment. From somebody saying, Hamish, did you ever get glandular fever in your youth? Maybe as a teenager, because this person noted that they've had similar viral health issues that led to worse stuff later.
Wow.
Maybe I'm projecting, but sounds similar to myself. Have you ever had glandular fever?
I think so. I actually can't remember. I think I did get it in high school, but I didn't have anything that kind of came. I didn't get any sickness like after that happened, as far as I'm aware. I'm pretty sure. I have to ask my parents. I actually can't really remember, but I vaguely remember getting glandular, but I'm not exactly sure. It knocks you out pretty bad. Virus, I do remember.
The virus remains in your body for the rest of your life, though it usually does not cause further illness. Interesting.
Well, usually.
Yeah, except in your case where it makes you sick every 2 weeks.
Yeah, maybe I'll check that out. That's funny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How you been anyway? What you been up to YouTube-wise? You been putting out content? How's it all going?
Yeah. Getting back into the swing of things. Yeah, like I said last week, I've kind of got a few different ideas that I'm kind of testing out. Got a few the bones of a few videos that I'm working on at the moment. It's a funny time on YouTube, isn't it? It's like it's always a give
and
take.
Hard, man.
It's always like putting out content you know will do reasonably well, or testing the waters in something that you know may flop or has the potential to take your channel to some other new level or some other new audience. You know, and introduce them into your broader audience. So that's always the game, right? It's a bit of you know, do I take a risk on this video or do I play it safe this week? It's a funny world.
And it's so hard because, like, for me, if I just look at the statistics, I don't really want to make these videos, but the statistics just say, do a Warren Buffett video, then do a Charlie Munger video, then do a Michael Burry video, and then go back to another Warren Buffett video. But if you, like, and sure, that may work for a time, but if you just keep doing that, your channel will fade because you'll run out of things to talk about.
Yeah.
And you see so many YouTube channels that do exactly the same thing.
Yeah.
They get their moment in the sun where it's like, oh, it's the new thing. And then they keep doing the same thing because it's been working, but people get bored.
Yeah.
They're like, oh, okay, I've seen that. So it's always such a hard trade-off because obviously with us, it's business as well. So you've got to do stuff that works business-wise and you know, covers the bills, but you want to make content that you want to make. You want to make content that you think is interesting. You want to make content that you think people will watch.
Yeah.
And it's balancing these things and keeping it fresh so that your channel doesn't go stale. It's actually really quite difficult to do. And sometimes we get excited about a concept or a topic that we want to do, but it's so obscure and we put so much time and effort into it and then it just flops.
Yeah.
Because it just hasn't hit that formula or that topic that people that follow our channels are interested in. So YouTube just spits it out and says, well, no one else will want to watch this because
your regular audience doesn't even want to watch it. Then you're like, ah.
Yeah. Anyway, I think from a viewer perspective, it probably looks like we just post a video and then post the next video. But it's really like, it is really strange. You've kind of got to like catch these like 6 month, 3 month waves of like interest, because it's not even just evolving the content and making it better, but audiences and what they enjoy watching that changes. And like you said, like the, you know, certain content might work earlier in the year, but if you just keep repeating that content over and over and over again, it just eventually just fades in interest. You have to kind of figure out, well, where's the interest now? What kind of video do people want to see? And it is like a constant, it really is a treadmill or like a rat wheel.
It's hard. Yeah. It is hard to do it well, to do it successfully. But, and in part, that's why we're trying to just make some of the courses just to, I guess, smooth out the revenue of the business, so that we can just do really interesting stuff. Maybe not every video hits, but at least it's interesting and it's varied and it's stimulating, I guess.
Yeah. But all in all, we're incredibly lucky to do what we do. I don't know about you, but like every time I wake up and it's like every time, there's like struggles and that sort of thing, but it's like, I would not rather do anything else than being able to do what we do. So I feel very lucky.
It's a challenge, but the awesomeness of it is that it is a challenge.
Yeah.
It's not just like, okay, I've got to wake up today. I've got to go and sweep the floor at work. And then once I sweep the floor, I clean the windows and then I go home. And then the next day I clean the bathrooms and then I got to do the vacuuming and then I go home. It's like, it is stimulating, and it's like, it hurts when it doesn't work out. It's really difficult sometimes, but then when it does work, then you really G'd up about it.
Yeah.
That's good.
100%.
It is a challenge.
Yeah.
All right, Hamish.
What
are we talking about today, mate?
Well, we got a new update, a new report released out of the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, talking about giving all of their 6 month forecast for Australia. There's some data around Australia, but also the world generally. And then I got a story about the Battle of the Stakes. There's two Australian companies with the same name at odds in Australia. So there's a really interesting story there.
This is so interesting because I have asked myself for years if this is ever going to cause an issue, because I've seen both of these companies. I've worked with one of them and I've seen the other one, and they're called the exact same thing. They have a slightly different logo, and I'm like, there's going to be a time where ding, ding. Yeah. So that's interesting that it's coming to a head. And of course, the big news of the week, the Sam Bankman-Fried case is continuing, and we now have some more information on Caroline Ellison's testimony. Ooh. So that is she was the CEO of Alameda Research and Sam Bankman-Fried's girlfriend for a time. So that's got some very interesting stuff in there. We've also got a little bit of news out of the Fed. We've got the Fed minutes just talking about exactly kind of what they are thinking over the next little while. And I got a bit of an update as well from the Birkenstock IPO, because that happened last week as well. I know we spoke about it last week, so I won't focus on it very much, but we'll talk about what happened when they went bang. All right.
Well, with that said, today's episode is brought to you by Seeking Alpha, your one-stop shop for stock analysis, market data, and news. Access expert analysis and news for thousands of stocks. View buy, hold, and sell ratings from members, Wall Street analysts, and Seeking Alpha's own algorithm. Screen for stocks using a variety of fundamental and technical analysis metrics. Access 10 years of financial data and company filings. And manage your portfolio by tracking your investments with price alerts so you never miss a buying opportunity again. Click the link in the episode description or head directly to seekingalpha.me/younginvestors to try Seeking Alpha free for 7 days. And you can also get a $50 off coupon at the moment. That deal is still running, so go check it out if you're interested. And as always, thanks to those who are using our links to sign up to these platforms and are supporting what we do here.
Also, just before we get started with anything else, I saw a comment on the most recent podcast which asked a question: do you choose the ads that pop up on your podcast? If you have handpicked the ads, what criteria do you incorporate in the selection process? So I thought that just before we went any further, we have been experimenting by putting Spotify inbuilt ads into the podcast. And
when you hear an ad that isn't read by myself or Hamish, that is just Spotify placing ads in the podcast. And we're doing that because we want to just cover our costs with the podcast. We want to make a little bit of money so we can just cover the costs and keep the podcast running. We don't have control over what ads get put in the podcast then.
Yeah.
Usually it's something to do with the topic. So it's usually something that we're talking about or financy or something like that. We don't have control over that. The things we do have control over are the actual sponsors that work with our podcast specifically, like ShareSite in the past, like Seeking Alpha, that kind of stuff.
Yep.
So I don't know if you have any criteria for sponsors, but for me, it's pretty simple. I just make sure that it's something that I use personally, or it's something that I genuinely think could benefit the people that listen to the podcast or my channel. That's pretty much my inclusion criteria.
Yeah, we get brands that reach out to us. But I think for me personally, most of the ads that I've taken, except for maybe one I can think off the top of my head, have been companies that I've used, and then I reach out to them and see if they want to do a deal. Just because that's generally the way that I like to operate. Like you said, like just products that I would use. And usually it's products that I literally am using, and I'm just trying to get a good deal for my audience or something like that.
Yep. So ShareSite for the podcast, ShareSite, Seeking Alpha, both myself and Hamish use those products.
Yeah.
And we think they're good, so that's why we partner up with them. But yeah, we get a lot of emails from other companies saying, hey, do you want to you know, pump this product and just stay well clear, because a lot of it's like crypto stuff anyway, so we wouldn't do that anyway. But yeah. Hopefully that clears things up a little bit. Also, one thing that's interesting, I don't know if you've checked the Young Investors Gmail account lately.
No.
But we get emails from like brand managers, like influencer managers saying, hey, exclusive opportunity to interview this person on the podcast. And people are like, this is the crazy world that we live in on social media. There are managers of influencers out there that are willing to pay us to feature people on the podcast, like to interview someone. How nuts is that?
Yeah, that is crazy. Yeah, it's weird. Yeah. I've seen a couple of those come in, but it's never anything particularly interesting. But it is a crazy ecosystem that we're in, though. Yeah.
It is bizarre. Yeah, it is bizarre. And yeah, honestly, if somebody is trying to pay to come onto this podcast, chances are I probably don't want to talk to them.
Yeah, I don't know if we would ever. It would have to be someone that we already kind of knew. Like, I don't know. If we were going to interview someone, it has to be someone we actually are interested in interviewing. I couldn't think of anything worse than interviewing someone just because you're getting paid and like you don't know anything about them before interviewing them. Like in my mind, that is just the worst thing. That would just be the worst experience. I don't even care if they're paying you a ton of money to do it. It would just be awful.
So
tell me,
born?
Yeah, tell me more about binary options trading for 18 to 20 year olds. Okay, yeah, you've got a course here. That sounds really interesting.
Tell me more.
Wow.
All right, Hamish, let's get into it. We got to start at the start. We got to start with this Sam Bankman-Fried stuff, surely.
Yes,
it's probably the biggest news of the week. Besides what's going on overseas, but that's not so much finance related. So I don't think we'll be talking about.
No,
I don't like talking about wars.
No, so I think it's obviously very sad what's happening, but it's quite a few places outside of our expertise. We'll leave that to other people to talk about.
But Sam Bankman-Fried, the case, the trial continues, and Caroline Ellison is giving her testimony. So it says here, Caroline Ellison, who ran Sam Bankman-Fried's crypto hedge fund while also, while also dating the FTX founder, has had her second day of testimony. Ellison, 28, pleaded guilty in December to multiple counts of fraud as a part of a plea deal with the government and is now viewed as the prosecution's star witness in Bankman-Fried's trial. In damning testimony on Tuesday, she said Bankman-Fried directed her and other staffers to defraud FTX customers
by funneling billions of dollars to sister hedge fund Alameda Research.
Wow.
Assistant U.S. Attorney Danielle Sassoon wasted no time diving back into the questioning on Wednesday when court was called into session. So, what have we got here? After previously detailing how FTX customer funds were used to repay Alameda loans, Ellison said Wednesday that crypto lender Genesis called back a bunch of loans in 2022 and asked to see a balance sheet. Because Alameda's actual balance sheet showed it had $15 billion worth in FTX customer funds, a big no-no, obviously, Bankman-Fried directed Ellison on June the 28th, 2022, to come up with alternative balance sheets that did not look as bad, she said.
Look, I'm no expert, but I think that might be a crime.
Yes, Hamish, I'm pretty sure that is illegal.
That's crazy.
I'm no expert, yeah, but I think if you murder someone, just, you go to jail.
I'm just using a bit of common sense here. No, that is crazy though. Okay. Yeah, wow. Yeah, I mean, we've been waiting to hear this because, yeah, I mean, yeah, I don't know really what to say about it, aren't we? Yeah, it's we're finally getting to hear from the person who probably knows the most inside stuff about Sam. And of course, you could potentially say, well, she's saving herself, so you know, you can really trust exactly what she says. But if it obviously lines up with other evidence, then you could probably believe her. But yeah, we're finally getting into the weeds of what's going on behind the scenes.
Well, I think this is interesting because what gets said here then sets up the cross examination. Where Sam Bankman-Fried's lawyers then get to grill Caroline Ellison on what she said in her testimony. So that's where it's going to get really interesting to see what they kind of hone in on. So this is kind of, I guess, the groundwork, like her recounting, like freely recounting what happened. And then after she's kind of done this testimony, then it goes over to the defense who get to grill her on what she said.
Yeah.
So, yes. So, unfortunately, Sam Bankman-Fried apparently directed Ellison to come up with these alternative balance sheets to give to this crypto lender Genesis, so that they could hide the fact that they had $15 billion worth of FTX customer funds on Alameda Research's books. Ellison said she discussed her concerns with Bankman-Fried as well as top executives Gary Wang and Nishad Singh. She said the group brainstormed ways to make the balance sheet look better. After the meeting, Ellison prepared a number of different balance sheet variations to send to Genesis. Eventually, according to Ellison, Bankman-Fried chose the one that omitted a line saying FTX borrows, hiding $10 billion in borrowed customer money. Some was netted against related party loans, she said, and some netted against crypto. That made it seem like we had, quote, like we had plenty of assets to cover our open term loans, end quote, Ellison said. Ellison told jurors, quote, she was in a constant state of dread, end quote, since she knew there were billions of dollars of loans being recalled that could only be repaid with money from FTX customers.
Wow.
She said she was worried about the possibility of customer withdrawals that could happen at any time. Quote, I was concerned that if anyone found out, it would all come crashing down, Ellison said. When asked by Sassoon why she continued with the scheme, Ellison said, Sam told me to.
Crazy.
By October 2022, the internal balance sheet had liabilities of $15.6 billion, while the numbers they showed the lender indicated just under $8
billion. Right.
So quite a discrepancy there.
That's insane. Crazy.
Yeah. But you can see, like, again, who knows exactly where the truth lies. Generally, you know, they say some, you know, two people give their recount of the situation. The truth is somewhere in the middle. So we'll see what happens. But, I mean, it's certainly pretty damning. She has basically come out and said, yeah, a lot of bad things were going on. And, like, even the brainstorming, they sat down and brainstormed what should be on the balance sheet. I mean, no, you don't get to decide what's on a balance sheet. It's a document. It's a financial statement. It comes from your accounting software.
Yeah.
It's like, you don't, oh, should we, what should we do? Should we just rub out this line of the balance sheet? How should we get those? Where should we disperse this? It's like,
I mean, it's
messy.
It's a crazy story, but somehow it does sound so much more believable that this happened than Sam's case, which is like, whoops. Like his defense is like, oopsie, oopsie, labeled account wrong.
Oopsie doopsie doo.
Oopsie, where'd the $10 billion go? Her story actually like sounds more credible, even though it is a crazy idea that this multi-billion dollar company is like, yeah, hang on a second. We've got these loans out. How do we move some, fudge some numbers around? Yeah, yeah. Hang on a second. We shouldn't have done that.
I like your description, Sam Bankman-Fried. Whoopsie. Where'd the 10? I've lost it. Where did it go? I can't see it.
I mean, basically.
Yeah. Oh, dear. All right. Ellison also spoke more about Sam Bankman-Fried's character and their relationship. Ellison said Sam Bankman-Fried directed FTX and Alameda employees to use the disappearing message setting on Signal and told them to be very careful about what they put in writing because of potential legal exposure. In addition to a company-wide meeting about the Signal policy, Bankman-Fried also told employees that they should only write things on Slack that they were comfortable seeing on the front page of the New York Times. Isn't that something that Buffett said in the Solomon case? Yeah. he's just taken after Warren Buffett.
That's
make
funny.
Sure anything yeah. you do, you'd be comfortable being on the front page of the paper.
He is a good guy after all.
He is a good guy. No, obviously this is not good at all. In August 2022, Ellison said Bankman-Fried blamed her for Alameda's finances, even though she'd been warning about FTX's expanding portfolio of venture investments and the need to repay FTX customer accounts. She said Bankman-Fried told her she should have hedged, and speaking loudly and strongly, it was her fault. Oh. On the stand, Ellison took some blame, admitting she should have done things differently. Quote, but Sam was the one who chose to make all the investments that put us in a leveraged position, she said.
Wow.
Ellison said she kept a Google Doc that had a subcategory labeled Things Sam is Freaking Out About. It included raising money from Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, as well as, quote, getting regulators to crack down on Binance, a rival exchange that was also an early investor in FTX. Bankman-Fried wanted to see Binance feel some pain because he saw that as the best way for FTX to increase its market share, Ellison said. Another worry on the list was bad PR in the next 6 months, which Bankman-Fried feared would interfere with FTX's efforts to obtain a license for futures trading in the US, she said.
Well, they've got a smidge of bad PR about now.
Smidge of bad PR. I was like, that's your top concern right now.
That is interesting. That his top concerns are everything but the fact that he's the mishandling fraud. Except for the fraud, the big fraud right in front of his face. Hang on a second.
What's that? The fraud? Oh, that doesn't worry me.
What's Binance's share price at right now? Is it going up this week? Oh, man.
What else did it say here? As testimony continued into Wednesday afternoon, Ellison was asked more about Bankman-Fried's concerns regarding bad public relations. She said he believed in a very proactive approach and spent a lot of time cultivating relationships with reporters. He invested in publications like Semaphore and The Block, a crypto site, and he considered putting money into Vox and Forbes, she said. How interesting is that?
Yeah. Well, we're hearing more and more about this, right? That he's just kind of spent an enormous amount of money trying to make his image look really, really good. It's been like a main, even with FTX itself, I think he spent $50 million for like 3 hours of Tom Brady's time or something insane like that.
Wow.
And he did that with I think Steph Curry had a similar deal. It was like $30 million or something like that for a couple of hours.
It's crazy.
So he really kind of had this concept of just spend as much money as possible to get as much brand awareness. And that's what we saw. I mean, FTX came out of nowhere. I mean, all of a sudden they had FTX Arena and it was on Formula One cars and it was just everywhere all of a sudden. It's just basically this huge amount of money. And well, now we know where that money came from.
They're paying YouTubers, influencers. There was one that got paid to actually do a full video on Sam Bankman-Fried, calling him like the most the most humble billionaire ever or something like that.
Yeah, so
there's a lot of marketing twisting perception, a lot of money spent in twisting perceptions of him.
Yep.
Bankman-Fried tried to cultivate an image of himself as a smart, eccentric founder and said he wanted FTX to be perceived as a safe, wanted it to be perceived as a safe, reliable, audited and highly regulated exchange with the allure of it being offshore, Ellison said.
Mm.
He used Twitter as a, quote, very important source to help control the narrative around FTX, she added. So there you go. I mean, I find it so funny. he wanted FTX to be perceived as safe, reliable, audited, and highly regulated. If you want that perception, why not just make FTX?
Why not just make it reliable?
Why not just make it that?
Yeah, that's so funny.
Why not just make it safe, reliable, audited, and highly regulated?
Well, it does just give you a window into his mindset, right? Like that's how his brain works. It's like it doesn't matter if it is safe or not. It's how people perceive it, which ultimately matters. And it shows in pretty much everything he did.
I would like new money to be perceived as a safe, reliable, audited, and regulated YouTube channel.
Hmm.
How might I go about creating that perception? Maybe, just maybe, it's around actually having the YouTube channel be a safe, reliable, audited, and regulated thing.
Nah, that's too much. That's too much work.
Tom
Brady. The answer is Tom Brady. Okay. Wrong. Is it A? Make it safe. Is it B? Steph Curry. C? Tom Brady. Or A or B and C?
Love it. What else have I got here? Bankman-Fried's personal look, particularly his hair, was also important to him. Ellison commented on how he dressed sloppily in 2022 and how he thought his hair was very valuable and key to the narrative. She said he swapped a nice company car for a Toyota Corolla because it was better for his public image.
Mm.
Ellison then went into her own emotional state. She said that when the business was imploding in November, she was on vacation in Japan. But she said that in Signal messages with Bankman-Fried that week, she told him that this was the best mood she'd been in for the whole year. Trying to fight back tears, Ellison said she went through a lot of mood swings and felt a sense of relief that she didn't have to lie anymore.
Wow.
After all the movement of FTX money, the company only had $4 billion to cover the $12 billion in customer holdings, she said.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's
crazy. So that's what was uncovered.
Imagine being on holiday. You're on holiday in Japan and you see the news that it's just imploded and you're maybe like you're the second highest person on the list of they're going to come after you. Yeah, pretty crazy. Yep.
Pretty crazy. But yeah, so that was just one day of this trial. So there's a lot more to come. There's a lot more to come.
Yeah.
And we'll keep you posted
as
it happens.
I don't know how long exactly the trial will go for. I'm guessing probably the better part of a couple of weeks, I would imagine.
I'm not sure.
Maybe not quite that long. And I don't actually know if we'll hear Sam testify. I'm not sure. I would guess probably.
I don't know.
Actually sure though. I haven't looked at, I don't know if that's public information yet, but I'm sure there'll be some, there'll certainly be some more juicy stuff to come. Yeah. I think.
Watch this space.
That
is the update on Caroline Ellison's testimony. All right, Hamish. Next, mate.
Yeah, let's talk about the IMF. So the International Monetary Fund released their sixth monthly World Economic Outlook and Global Financial Stability Report. Every 6 months they kind of put together this report, and there's a lot of interesting stuff specifically around Australia, which I thought we could talk a little bit about, and then some more kind of general global statistics. So they're forecasting 1.8% GDP growth for Australia for the full year of 2023, of this year, which interestingly is down from their April forecast, which was 2.5%. So within the space of just a couple of months, they've been kind of progressively downgrading that rating. And that tends to be how these forecasts work. They're not foolproof. No one's saying that they have a crystal ball or anything like that. But they do their best to estimate and then they kind of revise every few months. But it's been pretty much consistently revised down. They also downgraded their forecast for growth next year to just 1.2%, which is less than half the growth they expected just a few months ago. So again, their outlook for the Australian economy, at least over the next year or so, has been kind of getting progressively worse. Excuse me. And to put into perspective how bad 1.2% is, GDP per capita is expected to decline by 0.1% next year. So in other words, the IMF thinks that the economic growth next year is entirely due to just population growth. So if there was coming into Australia, and if there was no population increase, just the natural population increase, then the IMF is actually expecting GDP to decline next year, which is kind of a crazy statistic. So 1.2% is an extremely low amount, considering Australia has kind of this long history of growing their population pretty considerably every year. And even just that contributes in a meaningful way to GDP growth.
Yeah, that's hectic. So we're not really going anywhere next year, according to the IMF.
No, not really. Not really at all.
Yeah.
In terms of unemployment rate, back in April, the IMF thought Australia's unemployment next year would be 4.1% before rising to 4.7% in 2027. It now estimates unemployment will be up to 4.3% in 2024 and hit 4.9% in 2028. So slightly, again, they've kind of slightly worsened their prediction for unemployment, but those unemployment rates are still very, very good. I think pre-pandemic unemployment was like 5.3% or in the low 5% range. So they're still expecting unemployment to pretty consistently remain even below pre-pandemic levels.
I wonder what goes into their models for them to guess that it will go up from 4.1, 4.7, and then will hit 4.9% in 2028.
Yeah, it would be interesting to kind of see what's their methodology for doing that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you can guess what unemployment will be in 2028.
Yeah, I was going to say at the end, but yeah, you've got to take these kind of predictions with a massive bucket of salt, basically, because they adjust them every 6 months. It is interesting to kind of see where they're viewing things, but certainly they're very long-term views. It's not like you could really take that with any reasonable certainty. I mean, who knows?
What will inflation be in 2028? What will interest rates be in 2028? Yeah. That will influence unemployment. Like, who knows?
Yeah.
I feel like it's crazy to chuck out estimates like that. I don't really get it.
It is kind of crazy, right, that they still do that, considering we just went through a pandemic. And, I'm sure that if we looked at their predictions from 2015 looking forward, they would have probably said that the economy was on this kind of smooth, stable path. Yeah. And obviously no one saw the pandemic coming, but then that's why you probably shouldn't be making projections 5 years out.
Yeah.
But
it's bonkers.
Nevertheless, they'll try. They'll try.
It's like saying, I don't know, to you guys out there, like, what's the value of your stock portfolio going to be in 2028?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Like, I don't know.
Yeah, well, you're going to draw a straight line from here to here. Okay, It's gone up 1% the last year. It'll go up 1% and then 1%. Like, it's kind of silly.
A bit crazy. Anyway, there you go.
In terms of inflation, they're expecting 4% inflation next year. So just kind of continuing on this kind of slow downward trend. And then not getting down to below 3% until 2025, which would mean if that is kind of the trajectory that, we will have been in this kind of abnormal inflation environment for quite a few years at that point. When did we go above the 3% range? It must have been in 2021 at some point, I believe.
Yeah, maybe it would have been, I imagine.
Maybe late 2021 or something like that. So if it's not 2025 until we're back below 3%, you're talking about like
hectic
three, four years of being above target, which does compound, and it's already having a pretty significant effect. But that's kind of where they see.
Well, I think this is stats for America, but I guess can broadly be applied to most places. If you just look at not the inflation rate, but just the consumer price index over in America. Now versus just before the onset of the pandemic, things are like 20% more expensive now.
Yeah, because it compounds so quickly.
It does.
If you get, it compounds. It works the same as investments or interest, whatever it is. You know, 5% one year and then 5% the next year. That's not 10%. It's going to be more like, I don't know, 11, yep. 11 and a bit percent or something like that. And then the next year is even worse than that. So yeah, it's it is kind of crazy how quickly things can compound in your favor and against you. Like if you're investing, compounding is fantastic. If you have credit card debt, it's atrocious. And it, you know, inflation is the same. It all compounds and it can get out of control quite quickly.
Yeah.
Then there was some data around kind of mortgage stress in Australia, which has obviously been a very big front and center financial issue for a lot of places around the world, but particularly in Australia, given our kind of unique mortgage situation where we don't have these long-term fixed rates. I guess it's not unique, but we certainly don't have it compared to the US. Australians with mortgages have some of the toughest conditions of any country. We had the second highest interest rate increase. I always talk about like countries like
those pesky Australians.
It's so funny. Whenever I talk about data, even if it's Australian, I talk about it like I'm like sitting on the moon, like I'm looking down. You know what I mean? For some reason, I just I'm not even like considering myself like Australian when I read it, which is kind of bad.
I'm from Mars.
It's like I'm looking down. Oh, there though, there's Australians down there.
those bloody Australians.
Yeah.
Go, mate.
we had the second highest interest rate increase of 3% percentage points, only second to the US at 3.6%. We've had kind of some of the harshest increases in interest rates. But less US mortgage holders have felt that increase due to their long-term fixed mortgages. So the US has these kind of 10-year, 20-year, 30-year fixed mortgages. So even though they've had a bigger percentage increase in their mortgages, Australians have felt it more on their income immediately because we only have at the most like 2 or 3 year fixed periods. I think maybe up to 5, but generally it's been pretty variable. So pretty much everyone, at least right now, even if you fixed your mortgage in 2020 or 2021, pretty much everyone now is feeling the higher interest rates. And what that's meant is that US mortgage holders on average are spending 7.7% of their income on their mortgage, which has increased. But Australians are at the top of the list at 16.3% of their income is now going towards their mortgages, which is far the highest out of any of the countries that were being assessed.
Jeez. Yeah, that is crazy.
Yeah.
Makes sense, though. Definitely makes sense.
Yeah. This is slightly related. This was outside of the IMF's report, but a related story that I actually heard about on Equity Mates that I was listening to earlier in the week. CoreLogic, which does reporting around the world on the real estate market, they did a report on short-term sales of properties in Australia. So this is properties that have been bought and sold within 2 or 3 years. So in other words, properties that people kind of looking at all of the people who bought properties when interest rates were really low during 2020 and 2021. 8.5% as of the latest report, 8.5% of properties have been sold within 2 years of purchase, which is represents an increase. And 16% of properties have been sold within 3 years of purchase now. So a very large percentage of properties being sold are those from people who just fairly recently bought them. And even more kind of concerning is of those short-term sales, the percentage of loss-making sales increased from 2.7% to 9.7% in just a year. So in just a year, now 10% of those short-term sales, people who bought during the pandemic and are now selling, almost 10% are now selling below their purchase price, which is kind of a crazy statistic.
Yeah, and that's not even taking into account all the other costs that come with buying and selling, the transactional costs.
Yeah.
So that's very interesting. So these are people that have really been caught out by the interest rate rise, I guess.
Yeah.
And have had to sell.
Yeah, and you would imagine that probably a large portion of those are people who are within this kind of mortgage cliff that we've been kind of talking about. Yeah. Where a lot of people fixed 2 or 3 year fixed periods on 2.2%, 2.4% mortgages. And just recently that's rolled into, I think it's 6.6% is a pretty normal variable rate now. I've seen some up to 7%. So it's been kind of a very dramatic increase. And as you would kind of expect, some people were not prepared for that. I think most, the general stress test is for a 3% increase. So if you had a 2.2% mortgage, you would probably test, or the bank at least would probably test for 5.2%, and we're at 6.6. Yep. So we're well beyond you know, any kind of reasonable stress test that you that even a bank would do, let's say. So yeah, it's a pretty concerning, and I guess we'll kind of see.
It's interesting to see the story in the numbers though.
Yeah. And I think we're about halfway through the mortgage cliff. So about
mortgage cliff.
Yeah, yeah. So there's still quite a few people who will be rolling over. And then the other thing to consider is just the lag as well. It's not as if as soon as you roll into a higher interest rate that you would immediately be under, well, you could be under financial stress, but it's not as if you would immediately have to sell. Potentially you would try and work things around and make things work for a little period of time. Hope that interest rates go
savings.
Down. Dip into your savings. Hope interest rates go down before actually selling. So the next, I think, I know I probably said this at the start of the year, but I think the next 6 to 12 months will be very telling. And we don't really know what's going to happen. I'm not saying it's necessarily going to be bad, but we'll see more of this data.
The numbers are pointing in that direction now, which is the interesting thing. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, that's a big increase in just a year from 3% to 10% is the loss making sales. So that's, you know, a threefold increase in just 12 months. So,
yeah, that's rough.
And it was a record. It was a record.
Yeah. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Geez. Wowee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Very sensitive to those mortgages, aren't we?
Yeah. So hopefully, you know, hopefully we're through the worst, but we'll just see it as the data comes out, you know, every quarter, every 6 months. But yeah, getting back to the IMF, that was all of the Australian kind of related stuff. They also spoke kind of just more generally about the world. There wasn't anything too interesting. The only thing I picked out was just their projections for who's leading the economies, the biggest economies in the world, who's leading the world economy. The US is still projected to be the leader for the foreseeable future. They're not projecting any crossover between US and China in the next 5 years. Projected GDP for the US by 2028, so in 5 years, would be $32 trillion. China is projected to be at $23.6 trillion, which for reference is about the size of the US now. So they're expected in 5 years to match the US today. And then in third place, quite a bit further back, is India at $5.9 trillion, and then Germany and Japan. So that's their projections for the state of the world economy in 5 years.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, there's definitely two leaders on that list, isn't there?
Yeah, and it's becoming more and more clear. India is growing very quickly, but they're a long way away. So, yeah, it's very clear, and it's been clear that US and China are going to probably progressively get closer and closer to together, but certainly they're a lot further away from anybody else.
Yep.
So, yeah.
Gosh, don't tell Ray Dalio about this IMF report. He'll have a field day.
Do you think he knows?
Changing world order.
Do you think he's seen it?
Maybe, Hamish. Just maybe. All right, let's talk about the Fed real quick.
Yeah.
Because they've just released their minutes of their last meeting. Not too much to say on this, just a little bit of flavor from the data that we got, or from the decision that we got recently. Federal Reserve officials at their September meeting differed on whether any additional interest rate increases would be needed, though the balance indicated that one more hike would be likely, minutes released Wednesday showed. While there were conflicting opinions on the need for more policy tightening, there was unanimity on one point. Sorry, everyone, just had to work that one through in my head. unanimity on one point, that rates would need to stay elevated until policymakers are convinced inflation is heading back to 2%. Quote, a majority of participants judged that one more increase in the target federal funds rate at a future meeting would be appropriate, while some judged it's likely that no further increases would be warranted, the summary of the September 19 to 20 policy meeting stated. The document noted that all members of the rate-setting Federal Open Market Committee agreed they could proceed carefully on future decisions, which would be based on incoming data rather than any preset path. So there you go, Hamish.
Sounds familiar.
It does sound familiar, but yeah. There's a it sounds like there might be one more, but there is a bit of conflict, sure. I guess.
Yeah.
People saying yes, others saying no, which is much different to what we've had where everybody said yes.
Yeah, that's definitely true. If you go back like 6 months or 12 months, you can definitely see a big shift of like more rate hikes. And it was pretty, I don't know, I didn't think it was crazy for you to project that they were going to keep hiking. Now it's very much, I think everyone's kind of looking around at each other like, okay, who's going to make the first move? Who's going to try and do something and hope it doesn't make a mistake? Which country's going to push a bit further and then be the one that goes into a recession so that everyone can be like, okay, let's not go too far. I think that's like everyone's not too sure. I'm sure the Australia's looking at what the US is doing. I'm sure the US is looking at what the UK is doing and everyone's kind of looking around and just trying to be cautious, I think.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Another point of complete agreement was the belief, quote, that policy should remain restrictive for some time until the committee is confident that inflation is moving down sustainably towards its objective. The meeting culminated with the FOMC deciding against a rate hike, which we already knew about. However, in the dot plot of individual members' expectations, some two-thirds of the committee indicated that one more increase would be needed before the end of the year. The FOMC, since March 2022, has raised its key interest rate 11 times, taking it to the targeted range of 5.25 to 5.5%, the highest in 22 years.
Wow. There you go.
Since the September meeting, the 10-year Treasury note yield has risen about a quarter percentage point, in effect pricing in the rate increase policymakers indicated then. So there you go.
Right.
Maybe one more. Who knows? We'll wait and see.
Wait and see. Beautiful.
Nothing more to add on that one. Should we rock and roll into? I want to hear about the Battle of the Stakes.
Yeah. This is great. I only read about this.
Some would say the stakes are high.
The stakes are very high.
I'll see myself out.
They're very. Yeah. You've been thinking about that all the podcast.
I have.
waiting to release that. Yeah. So we've got the Battle of the Stakes. Two Australian companies will be kind of fighting over in court in Australia over the name. So I'll give a bit of context around the two companies because some people might not be aware of these companies. I'm sure a lot of people may have not heard of them because they're actually both pretty new companies.
Pretty new, yeah.
So the Aussie, so we have stake.com.au, which is the Aussie share trading platform. It was founded in 2017 by Matt Leibowitz. Leibowitz and Dan Silver. Yeah. They're based in Sydney and they're actually now the third largest broker in Australia, which is kind of crazy.
Hectic.
Only founded, 6 years ago? And the third largest broker. They have $2.5 billion in assets under management and 500,000 customers. So there you go. Massive kind of Aussie share trading platform. We've both kind of had deals with them in the past. We both are familiar with their company.
I've actually met Matt and Dan.
Yeah.
I don't want to influence the story at all, but they're really nice guys. Actually, I really like the guys at Stake, the guys and girls at Stake. They they're a good team.
Yeah.
I like them a lot.
Yeah,
they're nice people.
So that's the blue corner. In the red corner, we've got Stake.com, which is an online crypto casino, cryptocurrency casino. Boo! founded in 2016, so again, still a very young company. Founded by a 27-year-old Australian billionaire, Ed Craven. So both are young companies, both run by young Australians. One is a trading platform. One is an online crypto casino. It's actually one of the world's largest online casinos. So crypto casino, I think, makes you think, oh, it's probably this obscure little company. But they actually process tens of billions of dollars in bets. It's an enormous company.
Everywhere.
Yeah, I think
everywhere.
I was reading an article and it said as of 2021, in total, so between 2016 and 2021, they'd processed about $50 billion in bets, which is astronomical in a five-year period. It's an average of $10 billion in bets a year. And I'm sure they're a lot bigger since then. So what's the story? So Stake, the share trading platform, there's going to be a bit of confusion here, but Stake, the share trading platform, launched a legal action in a federal court in August to seek to enforce its trademarks and to stop Stake.com, a multi-billion-dollar enterprise, from using the name for business in Australia. They allege that the casino group, Stake.com, has been breaking Australian consumer law and has misled consumers through the use of its brand in Australia in its marketing, including sponsorship of the Alfa Romeo team, the F1 team, and the sale of apparel. So that's kind of what they're alleging, that they're essentially misleading customers, making people think that the two brands are related, that the two Stake companies are, you know, one in the same company. A spokesperson from Stake.com, the crypto gambling site, said, "We are aware of this frivolous claim lodged in federal court by Stake Shop," which is the actual company name, "which in part claims that our global Formula One team sponsorship impinges on their ability to sell trucker hats," which is a bit of a, it's a bit of a light dig at them. "We're proud of the global Stake.com brand. As a group, we abide by the laws of the countries in which we operate and do not offer our Stake.com platform to Australian customers. We believe the claims have no legal merit and will vigorously defend our rights." So that's kind of their response. So Stake, the gambling site, actually doesn't currently operate in Australia. But the court proceedings of this Stake versus Stake trial have revealed that they do actually have plans to expand here. So first of all, they actually tried to buy the stake.com.au domain from the trading platform. So they reached out, the crypto casino reached out and actually tried to buy the name from them, which obviously didn't happen, and probably would have been quite bad for the Stake's trading's business if they decided to give up that domain. But then they've also registered a number of trademarks, including Stake Australia, Stake Bet, and Stake Casino. Online casinos are currently banned in Australia, but they are seeking a license for sports betting to compete alongside the likes of Sportsbet and PointsBet and all those other sports bet sites. So there you go.
Interesting.
Do you have any thoughts?
Can you imagine the confusion in the courtroom? The jury is, I don't know what the legal speak is. They've come to their, "I've come to my decision.
We find in favor of
Stake. I award the case to Stake. Stake must now cease to use the name Stake. And Stake is now the only Stake that is allowed to be Stake." Wait, sorry, what? Can you just, I'm a bit confused. Who?
Hang on a second. Who won? Who won?
Yeah. There you go. That's interesting that it's all come to a head.
It does bring up an interesting question, right? Because they both have very simple names and one's operated outside of Australia and one's operating in Australia. But if they both have global ambitions, or ambitions in Australia even, which is kind of the core of this case, but there's eventually going to be that clash. And I'm sure it's not the first time it's happened where a company has a trademark of a name in a country and then they go, okay, let's expand internationally, and they don't have the trademarks, or there's another company with a similar name, so they can't operate because of confusion. Yeah, it is a weird.
It's interesting.
It's also weird because it is two money related things that are very different. Yeah. You know, one is obviously a trading platform, and one's a casino. So you don't want them to clash. And a customer could think that they're related because they're both money. They might think, oh yeah, this is just the trading wing, and this is the casino. I don't know. What are your thoughts? Do you have any thoughts?
Yeah, it's interesting, especially because Stake, the brokerage site, does also operate outside of Australia.
Oh, do they?
But only in a few markets. Okay. I think it's like New Zealand, the UK, maybe Brazil, if I'm remembering that correctly, but only like a few. And I don't think they're in the US. But that is interesting if Stake.com, the betting site, starts to go into some of those international markets, then there is a Stake versus Stake. Like, it is like, wait, which one? I'm confused.
Yeah.
Interesting. I'm a bit biased because obviously I know the Stake Australian share trading platform. I know the management there, but interesting to see where things will fall.
It's just it's like an unfortunate situation because they both were founded within a year, so you can't really expect them to have known that this problem was going to come up. I mean, you know, either of them within the first year would have been incredibly small companies, and companies and trademarks are made all the time. So there's no way you could always, you know, you could point and say, okay, that's going to be an issue. You know, that crypto casino that launched 6 months ago that has a similar name to us is going to be an issue. You just couldn't have known So it's just so unfortunate. And I don't know how this case will be found. I don't know what the legal situation is with this case, but yeah, is it certainly
interesting one?
Certainly funny. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. I'm going to give you a quick update on Birkenstock and then we can do a Q&A question or two.
Yeah.
So I was talking about Birkenstock IPO last week. The German shoe brand stock closed at $40.20 per share, down from its opening trade of $41 per share, giving it a market value of $7.55 billion. The stock's opening price came in lower than its initial price of $46 set on Tuesday, which was just shy of the midpoint of its expected range of $44 to $49 per share. So Birkenstock sold 10.75 million ordinary shares in the offering, raising about $495 million and initially valuing the company at $8.64 billion. Birkenstock had originally sought a valuation of up to $9.2 billion. So overall, they got this valuation of $8.64 billion.
Right.
The company's market debut comes nearly 250 years after it was founded by the German cobbler Johann Adam Birkenstock. It remained under family control until 2021 when private equity powerhouse L. Catterton acquired a majority stake in a deal that valued the business at $4.85 billion.
Right.
So,
wow, they've come out all right then.
They have come out all right. Yeah. In an interview on CNBC's Squawk on the Street, Birkenstock CEO Oliver Reichert explained why the company decided to go public. Quote, "The best thing for the brand would be staying family owned, but within the family there was so many problems. So we go for the second best option, and that's to go public and give the brand back to the people." So since L. Catterton acquired its stake, sales have grown and Birkenstock's valuation has nearly doubled. Between fiscal 2020 and 2022, sales jumped from 728 million euros to 1.24 billion euros. Over that time, the company grew direct-to-consumer sales, strategically exited certain wholesale partnerships, and focused on driving sales of items with higher price points. So there you go. Yeah. So L. Catterton acquired this majority stake in a deal that valued the business at $4.85 billion, and they IPO'd and in raising $495 million by selling 10.75 million shares, they got the valuation of $8.64 billion. So well done, L. Catterton.
Yeah, good deal. Hopefully the family's happy too. They got a decent deal, I guess. Well, yeah.
Yep.
I guess in hindsight, they probably could have just taken it public themselves, but
yeah.
But I guess that's the trade-off, right? You don't know what it's going to be valued at. It's like, do you want $5 billion or do you want to roll the dice with the public markets?
Exactly right. That's all I had to say on Birkenstock. Shall we do some Q&A?
Yes.
Let's do it.
Let's do it.
For those that want to ask a Q&A question, please go to the most recent YouTube version of the podcast and drop us a comment, or you can ask a question in the Spotify question box as well.
Yeah. All right. I'll ask this one to you. Hi, Hamish and Brandon. Thank you for the brilliant podcast. Love your content. Well, thank you. We appreciate you, listening and watching. Just curious, what are your top three red flags of a company's management team?
Top three red flags. I have been burnt by management teams in the past. I hate getting burnt by the management team. It's one of my biggest focuses now. It just sucks. I think overall, the one of the biggest red flags for me anyway is just when they overpromise, consistently overpromise, and consistently underdeliver.
Yeah.
They promise the world and then something happens and then they can't deliver and they go, oh, well, whoopsie daisy. And they don't really adjust their forecasts. They just keep promising the world and then they never deliver. So that's always pretty annoying. I really don't like it when they skirt around issues. When they sound like a politician, when they avoid answering or informing shareholders about the challenges and what's difficult, what the problems are at the business. Mm. And I copied your one a little bit here. I hate it when they get paid fat salaries and it literally does not matter whether the shareholders or the company does well or does poorly. They just get paid a mozza anyway. Yeah. That is so infuriating.
Yeah, I mean, if you're looking at companies anywhere, but US companies, for example, you've got to go into that proxy filing and just take a look at how the compensation is actually structured. Sometimes it's really complicated and it can be difficult to kind of go through it, but a lot of the time it's relatively simple. And if it's really complicated, that in and of itself could be a red flag, because it potentially is that they're trying to like hide something or hide how they're actually getting paid. But yeah, I think compensation is a big sticking point.
Just want to to interrupt. We haven't released the courses that we're working on yet, but if you're interested, when we do release them, in Introduction to Stock Analysis, we do a deep dive on explaining how to read the proxy filings and how to analyze the CEO's compensation. So if you're interested, like what's good, what's bad, that kind of thing. So if you're interested, when it comes out, I'll let you know.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah. The other one, I mean, they're all kind of similar to yours, but yeah, oversalesy kind of CEOs on conference calls, and not answering important questions. If you know, you can go back in history and kind of find where there was a problem that went on in the company or where management made a distinct mistake, and just listen to the conference calls and just, did they deflect or did they, you know, answer them kind of honestly? And then, you know, is the management team building ownership in the company themselves?
Oh, that's a good one.
Whether it could just be through their compensation, just holding onto the stock. But sometimes you'll see CEOs that earn $20 million and then every year they just sell it. And like, what do you think they're selling that? Do you think if they sell that stock, do you think they're holding $20 million in cash every year? No, they're buying other stocks or they're buying property. They're choosing to invest that money in something other than what they're touching and what they're, you know, actually controlling. Like, they're still investing the money. It's just they're choosing not to invest it in what they own. And of course, they're going to diversify to some extent, but it is refreshing to see when they really are passionate about building ownership and benefiting alongside us. That to me is a big deal.
Yeah. Yeah. Nice. We all of our things are on a similar line.
yeah.
Is that all of yours? Yeah. Yep. Cool. Let's do one more for today. Oh, here we go. I do want to just cover on this one actually real quickly. I'm asking myself this. Thanks for another great podcast. The intro is a bit out of control though. Can't you put half that stuff in a disclaimer or in the comments? Congrats on your license, Brandon. Thank you very much. Unfortunately, the answer is no. we can't. It does have to be said at the start of the podcast. Once you've heard it once, there is skip functions. You should listen to it every time, but you know there are skip functions, so you don't have to listen to it all the time. But unfortunately, that stuff does have to be at the start of the podcast. So apologies, but it is what it is.
Yeah.
But thank you for understanding. Yeah. All right, one more. Hamish, do you invest in bond ETFs?
No. Short answer, no. I think, honestly, I haven't really looked at bond ETFs. I think...
me neither. Yeah.
I think with where rates are now, certainly it could be a consideration. I think, it's a genuine consideration to have bonds as a part of your broader strategy, especially if you're trying to be a little bit more defensive. It's not something I've personally looked into. In Australia, you can get pretty close to bond rates with like high yield savings or term deposits, and that's often just a lot simpler if you want just simplicity to add kind of bonds into your portfolio, or add like basically high yield cash basically. But you know, it's not something I've not something I've personally looked into.
Yeah,
yeah,
yeah. Me neither. Honestly, me neither. For similar reasons that you mentioned. I'm also just like, I don't know, it's not a great answer, but I'm just not very inspired by bonds. I don't really have an interest in looking into them and tying down money. And I don't know, maybe if interest rates go up a lot and the story changes even further, then maybe.
I think as a young person, they're not as appealing as a part of a strategy as when you're older and you're trying to preserve your capital, or maybe you just want to smooth out your portfolio, you know, having more of a 40-60, if you have 40 bonds and 60 stocks, then when stocks go down 20%, your portfolio isn't down 20%. It's, you know, down, you know, quite a bit, marginally less, down like 12% or something like that. So, you know, as you get older and you're focusing more on preserving, and maybe you're looking to draw more on that capital, so you want there to be less volatility, less chance that you go through a 5-year period where it's down a lot, then that makes sense. But yeah, for young people, I think it depends. Maybe if you're storing money for like to buy a property in 5 years or something, you can buy some short-term bonds. But as I said, I mean, there's savings accounts that are pretty much get you, you know, 90, 95% of the way there. And that's usually a lot simpler for people to understand and manage.
Right. All right. And with that said, we will wrap things up for today. So thanks, guys, for sending in your Q&A questions. Keep them coming. We love them. We'll keep adding them into the podcast every week. Thanks, Hamish, as always, for joining me.
No worries.
And yammering on public companies for an hour. Love it.
Yeah,
love it.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Well, I'm sure we'll have some more updates for the Sam Bankman-Fried case next week, so stay tuned for that. But yeah, apart from that, guys, thanks very much for tuning in. Love you all, and we'll see you guys next week.
See you guys.